Yeah, it's not entirely clear what I'm supposed to be saying to you, so let me try and spend an hour saying it. What I'm interested in is the whole relationship between quantum mechanics and gravity. This doesn't have anything to, this isn't directly quantum gravity. Quantum gravity is a very, very hard problem. People have been floundering around in it for, 70 years or something like that, way back with both Schrödinger and Dirac, both got very interested in trying to set up a quantum theory of gravity that was based loosely on general relativity. So far, nobody has succeeded. Some people have claimed to have succeeded, but the proof of that is still a long way away. So instead, what I'm interested in is in that sort of overlap to try and understand how does gravity change things that happen in quantum mechanics, and how does quantum mechanics change some of the issues that you get in general relativity. One of the features that happened when relativity and quantum mechanics were developed back at the turn of the last century was that you had this sort of particleist versus wave kind of duality between various and sundry people. Newton, for example, believed that everything was particles, including all light, and had some difficulty trying to explain some of the interference effects he got with the so-called Newton rings and so forth. Huygens and Hooke were wave people who felt that somehow or other light had something to do with waves. Newton, primarily because of his status, won out until finally in the 1800s, at the beginning of the 1800s, you had a number of people and a number of experiments which showed that light was clearly a wave. Various interference experiments, the famous dot problem. If you have a sphere and you look at the shadow of the sphere, right behind the sphere, there's always a bright spot, which comes about because the waves diffracting around the edges of the sphere constructively add up right along that axis. And it became clear then that you had these waves, and then Maxwell developed this theory of waves, his electromagnetic theory. And the problem was that these sort of lived in relatively happy, but not entirely happy coincidence until about 1900. It drove all of the special relativity because the way in which these electromagnetic waves behaved in Maxwell's theory and the way in which particles behaved in your matter theory weren't quite compatible with each other, but Einstein sort of fixed that up. And suddenly, people began to realize that there was a problem. Quantum mechanics came up. Quantum mechanics was very much a theory about particles, the quantum mechanics of particles. Objects had attributes like position, which were operators, momentum, which were operators, etc. But they rapidly realized that this was really inconsistent with special relativity. Part of the problem is the problem of interactions. When you have two particles trying to interact with each other, in order that that interaction be special relativistically invariant, it really has to be a point interaction. So one seemed to be going back to Descartes. Descartes believed that the only forces between objects were contact forces. You had to be in contact with something in order to exert a force, which was one of the reasons why Newton's theory of gravity, where you had these forces acting at a distance, Descartes' theory had these big, sort of something like an ether with big whirlpools in the ether that carried the planets around with it. As being his theory of how the solar system worked, Newton suddenly came up with this theory where you had these actions at a distance, which of course in special relativity made no sense. And so after 1925, they desperately tried to make this particle theory, especially this quantum particle theory, look like, be special relativistically invariant. And they basically failed. Until finally they realized that the only way to go about it was to make everything a field. Now, particles have this thing about them. They are located at some place. They carry a definite amount of energy at that place. They are here rather than here. You can't be in both places at once. Fields, on the other hand, are always everywhere at once. And they simply have different, almost independent values from one point to the next. How in the world can one bring those two together? Well, over the next, from about 1930 till 1950, that was basically the big program in physics, is to try and bring those two together to develop what we now call quantum field theory, in which everything is a field. So even though it often gets called particle physics, it isn't. It's a field theory in which you have these fields where everything is always going on everywhere at once. That, of course, then raises the issue as to what in the world is a particle. And the common answer to that was the harmonic oscillator. People had solved the harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics way, way back when, in about 1925, might even have been in Schrödinger's original paper. And there you get this quantization of energy levels, and this quantization of energy looks a lot as though it had particle kind of properties, because particles have these lumps of energy. So if one looks at a quantum field, one can write it down in terms of its modes, basically Fourier transform the field. Then each of those modes looks a little bit like a harmonic oscillator, can carry a discrete amount of energy. If one adds these modes together, one can even make it look approximately localized. That's what a particle is. And this is sort of the standard story that gets told nowadays whenever you take a course in quantum field theory, etc. They take you through this quantization in terms of harmonic oscillators, etc. This, for me, became problematic from two different directions. One was that Steve Fulling realized that one could try and do quantization of the simplest possible field, a scalar field, doesn't have any other polarizations or stuff like that. So you don't have to worry about additional mathematical details. But quantizing it in Minkowski spacetime or in what's called Rindler spacetime, which is another spacetime, which is another coordinate system for flat spacetime. This is all ordinary, everyday flat spacetime. It's simply a different coordinate system in which everything is, again, time independent. The metric, all of the stuff is time independent. It's no longer spatially independent, but it is time independent. Can one do quantization in the standard prescription there? The answer is yes, trivially. You generalize it trivially. But is that quantization the same as of the quantum field, the same as for flat spacetime? Are the particles, these excitations of these modes, are they the same as you get if you do the quantization in flat spacetime? He didn't know. And I started getting worried about this question. Around the same time as well, Stephen Hawking came up with his result that black holes emit thermal radiation. I.e., if you sit far away from a black hole, if you do quantum field theory in the vicinity of a black hole, and you define your modes in such a way that they behave like flat space as long as you're very far away from the black hole, you find that even though nothing is coming in towards the black hole, stuff comes out constantly with a temperature. i.e., there are these particles that are streaming out of the black hole. Where do they come from? What are those particles? And that's the other question that was bothering me. The standard thing, well, you just Fourier transform the quantum field, then you get these modes. They look like harmonic oscillators. Quantize the harmonic oscillator, and you're done with the story. Well, we know that Fourier transforming is difficult because a Fourier transform more or less depends on everything being the same everywhere. And here you've got a black hole sitting there. The thing is no longer spatially independent. You have variation from one space point to the next. If you're far away or close to the black hole, things are behaving differently. What do you mean by how do you do the Fourier transform in that kind of a system? So this was the other problem that I was trying to grapple with, is trying to understand, in a sense, where do those particles come from that are emitted by the black hole and black hole evaporation? As a sidelight, that answer, that question still is not really properly answered, even now, 40 years later. But that's an aside. So what's a particle? I mean, in order to figure out where the particles come from, I've got to figure out what in the world I mean by a particle. After all, I've got this field, which is defined everywhere, and I'm trying to talk about these particles. What do I mean? Well, as I said, the usual answer is you do this sort of mathematical manipulation, harmonic oscillators, blah, 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 blah. There's a particle. But that's just mathematical manipulation. What's the physics in that? And especially what happens if that physics breaks down, as it should near a black hole. So I decided to take a different tack and more or less sort of in my mind think, well, if I walk into, you know, one of these particle experiments, an accelerator or something, what do I mean? What do I mean when they say that they've got a particle there? Well, what they do is they point me to this cloud chamber and say, look, there's this little track there. Or they point me to the Geiger counter and they say, look, that Geiger counter just clicked. That meant a particle came through. Okay, well, let me try and use that to define what I mean by particle. As I phrased it since that time, it's not how I phrased it at the time. Let me define a particle by that which makes a particle detector click. Now, seems a little backwards because, well, but I can imagine building a little particle detector. What is a particle detector? Something which sits there, and when this particle comes through, it excites it. And, you know, in the Geiger counter, it ionizes one of the atoms, the voltage in the across the two electrodes, strip the electron away from the ionized atom, accelerates the two of them, that ionizes more atoms, etc., until you get this little spark jumping across the gap. But the fundamental thing there is that initial transition of the atom from being, for example, sitting there in its ground state to being in its ionized state. So let's define a particle detector as being some object there which the quantum field can come along and cause to go to another state, jump from one state to another, a higher energy state. I don't want a lower energy state because, after all, we know that can decay all on its own. So it will, you know, a hydrogen atom in an excited state will naturally decay to the ground state. And it's not that it's absorbed a particle. It's probably that it's emitted a particle. So let's start it in its ground state, so it's not going to radiate. And I'm going to ask, what is the problem, you know, what is the field doing to it? I can now couple this detector to a quantum field and ask, how does it behave? Sure enough, if I take that detector and I sit it, you know, I can do the calculations relatively straightforwardly. I sit it there at rest, and I have the field around be in its vacuum state, lowest energy state. The detector just sits there. doesn't get excited. Okay, well, that's seeming to behave like a particle detector, right? If there's nothing around, it shouldn't do anything. Okay, now I can excite the quantum field into one of these single particle states that everybody, you know, the 50 years of physics before that had told me how to generate, how to define particles in a quantum field. I can have one single particle in there. And I ask, how does the detector respond to that? Well, if the modes add up in such a way that that particle misses the detector again doesn't click. Okay, this is hopeful. Seems to be behaving properly. In other words, if the particle misses the detector doesn't click. And if the particle does approach the detector, in other words, has a probability of being located at the detector, sure enough, the detector has a probability of being excited. So all of these were just to, you know, convince myself that this very simple system was behaving, this two-level system as I had it then, was behaving like a particle detector. It behaved the way you would expect a particle detector to behave in all of these normal situations. Then the question is, what happens if I bring this near a black hole? Well, if I'm holding it near a black hole, I know I have to accelerate it. There's a big tension in the rope. If to hold it just outside a black hole, I've got a big tension in the rope. So that particle feels that force. It's got to be accelerated. So let's do a simple problem first, which was Steve Fulling's problem. Namely, what happens if I look at this particle detector in an accelerated frame? I.e., I take this particle detector and I accelerate it. Let's take the state of the field to be the well-loved vacuum state, nothing in it. What happens to the particle detector? Well, your first response might be, well, obviously, there's nothing there, so nothing is going to happen. But that's not the answer I found. In fact, that particle detector will get excited. And it gets excited with a probability that's just the same as if it were in flat space and were surrounded by a thermal bath. A thermal bath whose temperature is proportional to the acceleration. In other words, the more strongly I accelerate this particle detector, the more it looks to this particle detector as if it's surrounded by a quantum field, which is hot, which has a temperature proportional to the acceleration. The more strongly I accelerate it, the more it clicks. Say, well, that should be an easy experiment to do, right? I mean, I can easily accelerate my favorite Geiger counter. You put in the numbers, and you find, I mean, the temperature then is h bar a over c squared, 2 pi c squared. The trouble is h bar is small, c is big, or h bar. I can never get my own formula right. As I said to somebody at lunch, whenever I copy a formula from one line to the next, I'll be sure to make at least two sign errors. So all calculations are a random walkthrough. And if I keep redoing it, I can sort of average the answers at the end. You know, the randomness cancels out. Anyway, h bar is very small, c is very big. It takes an acceleration of about 10 to the 22 centimeters per second squared to get a temperature of 1 degree Kelvin. That's a little hard to do. So it's a hard experiment to do, although people have suggested ways of doing an experiment like that. But we'll get to that. So this was rather a surprise to me, and I think a surprise to a lot of people as well. This means that the answer as to where the particles come from in the black hole, in a sense, still remains a puzzle. I have this particle detector. If I hold it far away from the black hole, it sees the temperature coming from this black hole, which is just the temperature that Hawking ascribed to it, proportional to the inverse mass of the black hole. The acceleration of that detector far away is almost zero. So none of the particles they're seeing at far away come from this acceleration effect. As I get closer and closer to the black hole, that temperature blue shifts. In equilibrium, you expect the temperature nearby to be higher than the temperature far away. It blue shifts, i.e. gets higher and higher temperature, just as you would expect. But at some point, as you get very close to the horizon of the black hole, that temperature simply becomes the acceleration temperature. Because the closer you are to the horizon, the more strongly you have to accelerate the detector to hold it outside the horizon. So far away, it looks like these are real, whatever that means, particles coming out from the black hole. As I bring that detector very close to the black hole, again, the detector clicks as though it was surrounded by a thermal bath. But now I can say that those particles are just there, because of the acceleration. Where did that transition occur? And this question is still a very open question and still confuses a lot of people. Some people will say, well, look, I bring that detector closer and closer to the black hole. The acceleration goes to infinity as I bring it right up to the horizon. There must be particles with infinite energy that sit just on the horizon of the black hole. On the other hand, in flat space-time, if I accelerate a detector with infinite acceleration, it also sees itself in a bath of infinite temperature, just as you do with a black hole. But surely you wouldn't call those guys real, because somebody who isn't accelerated would just see the vacuum state. Which of those definitions of particles is the right one? What do I mean by right? Still a very open question. How does one describe what's going on in the vicinity of a black hole in terms of, you know, where do these particles come from? Where are these particles actually being created as we look just outside the black hole? One could argue, as I do, that they seem to come from well outside the black hole, about 3m, 1.5 times the radius of the black hole, away from the black hole. That's somewhere in that region is where you can claim that the particles are being created. On the other hand, what do you mean by particle? So in an attempt to answer the question of what I mean by particle, I managed to even create more confusion, because it turns out that what I mean by particle can depend on how I accelerate this particle detector. What the motion of the particle detector is will change what I mean by a particle or not. Another piece of research that I did basically in order to answer the same kind of question was, and that had a sort of funny history. Back in when I was a postdoc at Birkbeck College with Roger Penrose, he was teaching. Birkbeck College is a small adult education college, basically. All of the courses take place in the evening so that the working man can come and take his university courses. And hold down a job during the day was the way it was when it was founded about 100 years ago. That's 150 years ago. That was the way in which that college was founded. He was teaching there at the time, and I was postdoc there. And Dennis Schauma was at Oxford, and they talked to each other. And one day, Dennis Schauma phoned me up and said, look, I'd like you to come to Oxford to give a colloquium, you know, on black holes or something like that. And I was desperately trying to figure out how to explain black holes. I mean, nowadays, everybody and their, you know, five-year-old kids know about black holes and so forth. In those days, black holes were a pretty new topic. My thesis advisor, John Wheeler, had just named them about 5 years earlier. And most astronomers thought that these were just sort of figments of the general relativist's imagination that had absolutely nothing to do with the real physical world. So very few people knew about black holes. And I was trying to think of, you know, how can I explain them? And I came up with this analogy of fish. Imagine you've got an intelligent bunch of fish, and in this world there happens to be this waterfall, which is particularly virulent, such that the velocity of the water goes faster than the velocity of sound. Then you've got a surface there, which is the last surface out of which sound can come and still get far away from the waterfall. Anything further down the waterfall than that, the water will sweep the sound waves over faster than the sound can climb up in the water. And that surface acts very much like a horizon of for these sound waves. And in fact, it looks very much, it has a lot of the same features as the horizon of a black hole does for light. Somebody falling in over the waterfall, if he yells, for example, his sound will get base shifted, because it takes longer and longer for each succeeding crest of the sound wave to propagate away from the waterfall. And so the wavelength gets stretched, the frequency drops, and in fact, that last sound that's emitted just at the horizon, just at that surface where the velocity of sound equals the velocity of water, will actually never get out. Well, that's just what happens with light around a black hole. So this was sort of a fun little analogy that I could use as part of my colloquium. And that sort of got left that way until about 10 years later, well, 8 years later, I was teaching a course at UBC and was teaching, it was actually in fluid mechanics. And while I was preparing my lectures, I started thinking about this analogy and thought, well, you know, now that I know a little bit about fluid mechanics, which I hadn't before, I never taken a course in fluid mechanics myself. Well, let me do some calculations. And I discovered that, in fact, sound waves in a flowing fluid behave in exactly the same way as scalar fields do in a background metric. The flowing fluid creates an effective metric for the sound waves that can be made to look exactly the same as, for example, the metric around a black hole does. In particular, if the velocity of the fluid becomes higher than the velocity of sound, you get a black hole. You get the exact analogy of the metric of a black hole for these sound waves. That meant that I could go ahead and do Hawking's calculation again, but for these sound waves. And basically, I could follow Hawking's calculation step by step, and I get exactly that this surface of these this fluid should quantum mechanically again emit thermal radiation. The temperature is now not proportional to the mass. Fluid's constantly flowing in, so the mass keeps increasing. It's got nothing to do with the mass or the energy. But in this case, it's proportional to the rate of change of velocity of the fluid as I go through the horizon. And I suggested at that time that this might actually allow us to do experiments in which one could perhaps see the Hawking radiation in a laboratory situation. Then, I guess last, about 3 years ago, one of my postdocs came to UBC and said to me, Bill, you know, we really should do an experiment like this. She actually wanted to do a slightly different one. This one turned out to be easier. And, she, you know, under her constant goading. This was Silke Weinfurtner. A group of us finally did an experiment in which we showed, in fact, that in this case, it was surface waves and water. And you've got a water flow which goes over an obstacle, so the water has to flow faster over the obstacle than away from the obstacle. You can again get a black hole in that situation. And one can do experiments that, in fact, mimic exactly what goes on in a black hole. And we showed in this case that the quantum radiation, we couldn't exactly see the quantum radiation itself, but that the quantum radiation should again have a temperature just given by the rate of change of the velocity of the fluid as it went over that boundary, which was a lot of fun. But it illustrates one of the features of physics and of theoretical physics, in that analogy can play an extremely important role in giving us new insights. In this case, it was the analogy between sound waves in a flowing fluid and general relativity, which at first seemed to have no relationship with each other. But that analogy can actually cast the problem in a new light. In the sound wave case, one can again ask the question, if it emits this thermal radiation, where do the particles come from? Question still isn't really answered, even for that simple case. Because again, it becomes difficult to know exactly what one means by the particles. One has a quantum field theory, and quantum field theory isn't a particle theory, even though everybody calls it particle physics. It's not. Nobody does particle physics. People do field theory. What lessons can I draw from this? I think one of the lessons I like to draw is whenever you're doing, you know, most of you are here because you've got some interest in doing theoretical physics. But whenever you're doing theoretical physics, always think about measurability. Don't just think about how do I get the mathematics from one point to the next? How do I solve this equation? But think of what does this equation mean? What do the solutions mean in terms of measurable quantities? If I'm doing quantum field theory near a black hole, and I want to ask what's happening with the particles, you don't just simply write down some mathematical definition of a particle that your teacher told you what particles were in quantum field theory in your quantum field theory course. You ask the question, what does it mean? How do I know that there are particles there? What do I mean when I say that there are particles there? How do I differentiate those particles in various situations? And that can very often, I mean, sometimes it confuses the situation, as it seems to do with black holes. But it gives one a much deeper insight into what's going on. Similarly, in the fluid mechanics case, you know, how in the world can we measure Hawking's result? It would be, of course, nice if one could have a small black hole and actually see it emit thermal radiation, quantum thermal radiation. And in the first few years after Hawking suggested that black holes evaporate, a lot of people were looking around and saying, you know, well, maybe these gamma ray bursts, maybe that's the end of a black hole evaporating there. They rapidly did calculations which showed that if we were going to see one of these gamma ray bursts occur in our lifetime, you know, one of these black holes evaporating in our lifetime, the density of black holes in the universe would have to be much, much, much bigger than that required to make the universe smaller than our galaxy. So the chances of us actually seeing a small black hole evaporating are vanishingly small. But is there some way of measuring it? Can one find a situation which one can actually measure the same kinds of an effect? And the answer turns out to be yes, that there are condensed matter systems in which one can do that, etc. So one of the things that you should always keep in mind, not necessarily the top of your mind, but in the back of your mind, is how do I measure stuff? How do I measure these effects that I'm going to be looking at? And if they turn out not to be measurable, even in principle, one of the advantages as theorists have is that we can build measuring apparatuses that no experimentalist could ever build. You know, and we can, with a stroke of a pen, say, let us say that we accelerated this box to 99.99% of the speed of light. Well, that's easy for us to do on a piece of paper. It's a little bit more difficult for an experimentalist to do, not least because that box will disappear from the laboratory very rapidly. And you can't catch up with it. So it's hard to query it after it's gone away. But at least in principle, can we make these measurements? And that can often help you to sort of dig your way through what's important in your calculation and what's sort of, well, mathematically interesting, but really irrelevant. I don't know if I have terribly much more to say, so I've dumped a lot of stuff on you. But why don't I open the floor for questions at this point? Yes?
Earlier you said you did a calculation of the speed at which you'd have to move the detector to register 1 degree Kelvin. And you gave some number in, I think you said centimeters per second.
Second squared. So you have to accelerate it at about 10 to the 22 centimeters per second squared to get 1 degree Kelvin. That's a fairly high acceleration. That's what, 10 to the 19 G? Somewhere between 10 to the 19 and 10 to the 20 G. Now, one of the places where you get that is in fact in particle accelerators. So Bell, John Bell of Bell Inequalities, that some of you may have heard of, he was a particle physicist. His day job, as he called it, was particle physics. He always felt that his work having to do with foundations of quantum mechanics was actually a hobby, which he shouldn't do during his day job. But this effect, he felt, was perhaps had something to do with particle physics. So if you imagine you've got a storage ring and you have, let's say, electrons that you're keeping in the storage ring, and they're whizzing around at 99.99999% of the speed of light, you can calculate what the acceleration of those electrons is. And the temperature, the temperature that corresponds to that is somewhere around 1,000 degrees Kelvin. And you can calculate what is the, so the way in which they're accelerated is that they are put in a magnetic field, and then you have them whip around there. You've got to keep giving them low kicks because they emit electromagnetic radiation and gradually slow down. So you got to keep giving them kicks to keep them going at that velocity. But they're basically just whizzing round and round the storage ring inside a magnetic field, which is what's causing them to curve. That same magnetic field also acts on the spin of the electron and polarizes the electron, giving the upspin a different energy than the downspin. Well, that little thing acts just like that kind of thermometer that I talked about. Namely, I've got a two-level system, and I would expect the electron to start off in its ground state and occasionally get excited into its excited state. So if I now allow this electron to sit in this storage ring for a long time, if it sees itself surrounded by thermal radiation, then it should come into equilibrium with it. Namely, the electron in its ground state and in its excited state, it shouldn't completely be in its ground state, but it should have some probability of being in its excited state. just given by the thermal factor, you know, e to the minus e over kt, where k is Boltzmann's constant. And when they plugged in the numbers, they found that that electron, instead of being 100% polarized, namely pointing in only one direction, it should be only about 92% polarized because, you know, of this thermal radiation surrounding them. So that's a possible way in which one has high enough accelerations that one should possibly be able to see this depolarizing of the electrons. It actually is a problem, that depolarization of electrons, because very often one wants to do experiments in which one sends in a polarized beam of electrons to find out what the spin dependence is of scattering cross sections and so forth is. So you'd like 100% polarization, you only get 92% polarization. You actually get less than that because there are other things, inhomogeneities in the magnetic field, et cetera, that can also depolarize the electron. So separating out this acceleration effect from that from other depolarizing effects is difficult, but it's an experiment that should be doable and one should be able to see it. So that's one place where one might get accelerations that are high enough that one can do it. One of the problems there is that that's circular acceleration rather than linear acceleration, and it turns out that the quantum field theory is slightly different for circular acceleration than linear. The temperature isn't uniform. The temperature is a mild function of frequency. It differs by about 20% from one frequency to the next, so it's not exactly a thermal bath, etc. But it's a fairly good approximation. So, you know, the problem, of course, is that if one were to take one steak and one wanted to cook one steak in this acceleration bath, the acceleration, you know, would need to be about, I don't know, 10 to the 25th centimeters per second squared, at which point the steak would rather get squashed rather than cooked. But if one could get around that minor problem, one should be able to cook one steak by whirling it around one's head sufficiently rapidly so that it saw the thermal acceleration radiation. Yes?
You mentioned earlier how can we measure these things of black holes in condensed matter systems, right? So there are actually two questions. The one is, do you know any system where one can see this type of things in condensed matter? And the second one is that if this suggests that one can couple gravity and quantum mechanics in a condensed matter setting or something like that.
Sure. So first thing is, the experiment that we did was, in a sense, a stimulated emission experiment rather than, it turns out that black hole evaporation, is, you know, a la Hawking, is really the same kind of noise that one gets from an amplifier. Any amplifier, any linear amplifier, will produce quantum noise. That quantum noise is completely determined by the amplification properties of the amplifier, which you can determine by just sending in a classical signal and seeing how it gets amplified. So you're basically doing what's called a stimulated emission experiment there. And the parameters of the stimulated emission tell you how much quantum emission you get out of it. So this was the experiment that we did. And we showed that via this kind of stimulated emission, that this waterfall system should, in fact, produce thermal radiation, given just by the equivalent kind of formula as Hawking's for this particular system. Directly to see the quantum noise is much more difficult. In the water system, the equivalent quantum noise would have a temperature of about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. Now, 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin is a little bit cold for the water in Vancouver. Here, wait until it's winter time and you might think it's getting close. But even here, that's a little bit cold for the water here as well. So you're not going to do it with water. Maybe you could do it with liquid helium. It turns out in liquid helium, the big problem is that if one puts enough pressure on the helium, forcing it, for example, through a nozzle so that it went supersonic as it went through the nozzle, you've got to put so much pressure on it so that it solidifies. And solidified liquid helium is not very liquid. So there have been a number of people that have tried to make suggestions as to how one might be able to see the quantum effect. Bose-Einstein condensates, the velocity of sound in Bose-Einstein condensates is millimeters per second, and it's easy to make something flow at millimeters per second. And there, again, the equivalent temperature is about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin, and Bose-Einstein condensates, that's the kind of temperature they have. So maybe one could see it there. The trouble is then you have to see quantum radiation at frequencies of kilohertz. And detecting single kilohertz phonons is really tough. So that's another possibility. There's another possibility, and that is using light. If one shines light in a medium, one can arrange a situation in which if you shine a very intense pulse of light into the medium, it will change the refractive index due to nonlinear effects inside the medium, and you can get a short region in which the velocity of light inside is slower than the velocity of the pulse. If one now goes into the frame of the pulse, it means that a little light perturbation inside the medium sees one of those edges as a black hole horizon and the other edge as a white hole horizon. And one can make the effect of temperature there much, very high. And there are a few groups in the world that are, in fact, trying to do exactly that kind of an experiment to create black hole or white hole horizon. White hole is just the time inverse of a black hole. And see the quantum emission due to those horizons. There was a paper a couple of years ago where they claimed to see it, but that paper is almost certainly wrong. They saw something, but it wasn't this thermal emission due to the horizon. But I think they're very close. So there are, I think, a number of situations in which, yes, one actually might be able to see the quantum emission directly from one of these horizons in a condensed matter system. Then the question is whether or not that says that gravity is really just a condensed matter phenomenon. And there are people who have wandered off in that direction. You know, the big problem with the quantization of gravity, well, maybe it's just a condensed matter system. You just quantize the condensed matter system, then you're all finished. You don't have to worry about quantizing gravity. Over the last few years, there's been a lot of interest in something called Harava-Lifshitz gravity. Harava suggested basically a condensed matter system that maybe could be made to look like a gravitational system. They tend to have real problems, however, because the velocity of waves inside materials tends to depend on what the wave is. So, for example, if we look at the Earth, we know that we've got these pressure waves inside the Earth. We've also got shear waves inside the Earth. And shear waves travel with about a third the velocity of the pressure waves. So therefore, the velocity of light for the shear, the velocity of light, if you will, if you're using this as your analogy, for shear waves is different from the velocity of light for pressure waves. Well, this is universally what happens in condensed matter systems. So why in the world does electromagnetism, pions, electrons, all of these waves have exactly the same velocity of light? If these were some sort of excitations in some condensed matter material, surely they would all have different limiting velocities. You know, as the wavelength gets very short, their velocity should all limit out to some different value for each one of these waves. So electrons and neutrinos and light all should have different limiting velocities, whereas the experimental evidence, despite what you read in the paper sometime, the experimental evidence is that everything has the same limiting velocity, namely the velocity of light. So, you know, models like that have, people are playing with them, people are trying to see what they can, they can do, they have problems as well. So, I mean, this is just an illustration that as soon as one comes up with an analogy, it also opens up all kinds of different things that you can look at. And of course, as theorists, one of the things we're always desperately searching is questions that we can ask so that we can answer them. And, you know, if you come up with a new analogy and you get a new question you can ask, that's exactly what a theorist wants to do. Because that gives them a job, namely answering the question in this new context. Yes?
So what's in with the question of where the particles come from, like what's wrong with the hypothesis that like there are vacuum excitations and one of the pairs gets sucked into the black hole and the other gets emitted? Is it?
This was the model. I mean, Stephen Hawking, after he wrote his paper in 74, was asked to write an article for Scientific American. And in trying to write his article for Scientific American, he came up with this little model, you know, this little sort of explanation of, you know, you have these particle pair, you know, you have this, the quantum vacuum has all of these little quantum excitations and particles and antiparticles get created and destroyed, and that maybe one of these particles falls into the black hole and then the other one escapes, and that's what causes the black hole evaporation. The problem is that that kind of hand-waving argument about these quantum fluctuations is in general a load of garbage anyway, even when you do that in the cases in which it was actually originally discussed. And when you do it in black holes, there really aren't any calculations which support it. In other words, when one looks at the quantum field theory and says, can I go look in my quantum field theory and see this kind of an effect going on? The answer is basically no. It's not quite true, because there are some suggestions that perhaps something like that picture is right, but certainly not in the naive way. And as I say, nobody has really managed to produce a decent calculation which shows that kind of thing happening. So it's a nice picture, okay? But one of the things that one wants with one's pictures is that the intuition that those pictures develop for you is somewhat robust. If when you have the picture and you try and draw any conclusions from that picture, you get the wrong answer, that's probably the wrong picture to have. And that's what, in a sense, tends to happen with that picture. You don't really have any calculations which support it. There's some suggestions, I mean, that's what I'm saying is slightly going overboard. There are some suggestions that there may be something actually correct in that picture, but it certainly doesn't come out directly from any of the calculations that one does with the quantum field theory. Yes?
Why do we need to describe these slips and cases in terms of particles at all? Couldn't we just have a theory of the behavior of particle detectors without actually having particles?
Sure. I mean, in a sense, that's what we have. The theory that we have is the quantum field theory. The problem is that, one, as I said, you want to develop your intuition. You don't want to simply say to somebody, I've got this situation here. What happens in that situation? And you just tell them, well, go off and calculate. You want to be able to wave your hands and saying, this is the kind of thing that I expect to happen. Also, as a theorist, it really helps in doing a calculation to know what the answer is. In fact, my thesis advisor, John Wheeler, said, one of the key things in theoretical physics is to never do a calculation before you know what the answer is. How would you know the answer? Well, the answer you get through some kind of physical argument, some kind of intuition, etc. Sometimes, of course, that answer is wrong. And then when you do the calculation, you see that the answer is wrong and you learn something because, you know, your intuition has been betrayed. And that helps you refine your intuition in these new situations. So that's part of the reason why you would like to know what's going on. Is there some more intuitive way in which I can understand what's going on in this thermal emission from black holes. Like that little example, you know, of little particle antiparticle pairs, one falling in, one going out to infinity, which doesn't really work.
Should we expect our ordinary intuition to be extendable to cases that are so far from the experience on which the intuition is based?
No, but that's part of our job as theorists, is to in fact hone our intuition so that even when we get into these weird situations, which for the common man would be totally weird, but you know, we've now trained ourselves well enough that we've been able to produce our intuition in such a way that we can expect, you know, we can figure out what we expect to happen in these situations. So part of the whole purpose of being a theorist is precisely developing one's intuition in such a way that, you know what the answer is before you do the calculation. It's one of the things that really annoys graduate students, you know. I mean, they go off, they have their thesis supervisor, they get this problem, you know, however, and they go off and they work and work and work, and 6 months later, they walk back into the thesis supervisor's office and say, okay, you know, I've been working now for 6 months, day in and day out, and here's my answer, and the thesis supervisor takes it and he says, something wrong here. Yeah, that answer can't be right. What, have you done the calculation? No, I haven't done the calculation, but here's my arguments. And they will then go through a series of arguments to show that, you know, their intuition and these series of arguments show, no, it doesn't work. You know, without having had to go through that whole long calculation.
Or if the sometimes the student will beat them down and eventually get them to admit.
Well, that's true too. That's true too. Sometimes, you know, the thesis, it happened to me just a few weeks ago. You know, the student will come in and say, and you'll say, well, you know, that doesn't feel right, blah, blah, blah. And the student will go away and come back through 2 weeks later and say, no, I still get that same answer. And, why is my intuition bad in this situation? And eventually, you know, out of that conversation, you'll suddenly get new insight. But, you know, that's part of your training as a theoretical physicist is precisely in trying to develop your intuition more and more. And then you can always, you know, sometimes it's wrong, but you learn when it's wrong. And if you don't have the intuition, then you've got nothing to test the calculation against. You know, you don't know when to go back and check it and find that stupid minus error, you know. I didn't do it quite often enough, so my average still contained that one sine minus error in it. Or there is no minus error, and your intuition is just wrong, and then you find out why that intuition is wrong. Yes?
Do you have any intuition as to what might happen if you let, like, what that detector might see if you let it fall into the black hole?
So the detector will see a little bit, in part because the surrounding space-time is changing. You're falling in towards the central singularity, etc. But he shouldn't see terribly much. He certainly shouldn't see a diverging amount of energy as one gets near the horizon, which that other argument suggested there should be. He will just see, you know, a little bit of radiation before he finally gets crushed in the central singularity. So, you know, the cartoon parody of that is that the freely falling observer won't see anything. Just as the freely falling observer in flat space-time in the vacuum state doesn't see anything, right? The particle detector is just sitting there in flat space-time, doesn't click. Similarly here, the particle detector falling into the black hole doesn't click. One of the problems, of course, in defining that is that inside the black hole, you've got that central singularity, which destroys the detector. And you know that the detector has to live for a certain length of time, such that the frequency of the radiation it's trying to detect, there's a few cycles of it. But the time it takes for the detector to hit the central singularity is about the same as the frequency of the peak of the radiation that Hawking says comes from out of the black hole. So it's hard to define what that detector sees as it's dropping into the horizon. But if one looks at the much higher energy, much less probability, but much higher energy, you shouldn't see anything. Whereas the accelerated detector, the closer you bring it to the horizon, the one that you hold outside and therefore accelerate, the closer it comes to the horizon, the more it sees, the higher the temperature it sees. And in fact, it diverges as you get it right up to the horizon. Somebody else, did you have your hand up?
Sort of.
What is a sort of hand up?
So my question is, you have this fluid dynamics sort of analogy of this Hawking radiation. My question is, can you maybe find a singularity in that analogy and study the physics near it?
So in this case, the analogy is that the flowing fluid has a metric. The problem is that that metric doesn't obey Einstein's equations. The metric is determined by the velocity of the fluid, and the velocity of the fluid obeys Navier-Stokes equations or, you know, the Euler-Lagrange equations, whatever, whether you have viscosity or not. And those are very, very different from Einstein's equations. So in the case of the fluid, you don't get the same development of the metric that you do, and you don't necessarily get a singularity. Hand-wavingly, you can argue, oh, sure, there's a, you know, you go to Niagara Falls, you look down at the base of the falls, that's a singularity, right? So yes, inside the waterfall, you do get a singularity. Again, because the water is hitting all those rocks. Actually, Niagara Falls isn't high enough to produce a sonic horizon. You need a waterfall that's about 1,000 kilometers high in order for it to be fast enough so that the velocity of the water is faster than the velocity of sound. And we don't have many of those on the surface of the Earth. So one needs a special place, you know, like Terry Pratchett's Discworld, where everything travels much, much more slowly, including light and sound travel much more slowly in Discworld than they do in our world. And so there, the big waterfall at the end of the... Any of you read Terry Pratchett? Anyway, it's set in this world in which magic rather than material science dominates the understanding, and it's this flat plate with its mountains and a big ocean riding on the back of a turtle which swims its way through space. And at the edge of the world is this water where the waterfall falls off the edge of the world, so there would presumably be a horizon. People have asked him what the water falls off the edge, how does it get back? Because otherwise you drain the oceans. And his answer is, it's arranged. Anyway, so if you go to Discworld, then you may be able to do this experiment there. But in our world, it gets a little bit more difficult, except for artificial situations like Bose-Einstein condensates. There you make a waterfall about this high, and you can actually produce a horizon in it. There the problem is getting enough Bose-Einstein condensates. Any other questions? Gone over time.
Okay. So before we stop, actually I want to ask, are you, so you're here through the end of this week.
Right, leaving Friday afternoon.
Plans to come back later in the year?
I don't have any plans right now.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so I'd like to thank Bill for